Chance of snow tonight up to an inch, low 17 to 24, and highs tomorrow in the mid to upper 30s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Chilled to the bone, a serial killer who terrorized a community in New Brunswick has died in prison. We reach a reporter who says he will never forget the toughest assignment of his career and how it felt to be on that murderer's radar.
And mouse potatoes. A scientist tells us how he's been studying what mice appear to experience when they watch movies like The Matrix and Mad Max, and also why he's been studying that.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There's more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on People Powered KAXE. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997. A local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. We also thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We're going to sample our album of the week right now. It's called Land of the Forgotten by Britt Taylor. It's the third album from this Americana country singer, produced by her husband, Adam Chaffins, also her co-writer. Inspired by 80s and 90s country music, Land of the Forgotten is a tribute to her home of East Kentucky and Appalachia. Let us know what you think. Text 218-326-1234. We are going to hear the title track. It is Land of the Forgotten by Britt Taylor.
Forgotten, there ain't no interstate. There's parkways and three lanes and a stop or two to fill up the tank. In the land of the forgotten, where the valley's mundane and the rolling hills are steep, right down to Troublesome Creek. and the crater holds the bones of everyone who's ever called it home. The land of the forgotten.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Stumbling block. The one thing standing between Prime Minister Mark Carney and a majority government may turn out to be a by-election in the Quebec riding of Terrebonne, where the Bloc Québécois candidate says she's confident she will win.
Looking ahead, but not necessarily looking forward, it's not clear when the war in Iran will end, but we'll ask an Iranian-Canadian historian what kind of order he foresees after the chaos.
A long-awaited ending. New Brunswick serial killer Alain Légère dies in prison. A reporter who covered the murders, the manhunt, and the trial tells us a lot of people are breathing easier.
Underwater, heavy rain in Nairobi last week led to deadly floods. And for many, including our guests, those floods cut off electricity and running water.
Seeing the world through mouse-colored glasses, a neuroscientist tells us about the leap he's made in understanding how mice view their surroundings with the help of action movies.
And out of the running. Just weeks before athletes were scheduled to run the Pyongyang Marathon, the North Korean regime cancels the event. And the reason it gives is reasons. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that assumes for the more out-of-shape runners, this is a staggering loss. Federal Liberals really, really want a majority government. Right now, they're looking hungrily at the Quebec riding of Terrebonne. It's one of three ridings where by-elections will be held in April, and it seems the biggest by-election challenge for Prime Minister Mark Carney's party. In Terrebonne, the last election was a bit of a fiasco. To recap, you might want to take notes, the riding was initially called for the Liberals. Then, after a validation process, it flipped to the Bloc. Then came a judicial recount that gave the riding back to the Liberals by one vote. And then, after a long legal fight, the Supreme Court annulled the result because one Bloc voter came forward saying she had tried to vote by mail, but that her vote had been returned uncounted. Nathalie Sinclair Degagné is the Bloc Québécois candidate in Terrebonne once again, and that's where we reached her.
Nathalie, are you sick of the campaign trail at this point?
Not at all. I'm happy to be back. I mean, there was something unfair that happened a year ago, and I had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get a new election so we can actually have in Terrebonne a representative that has been duly elected. So I'm happy to be back in campaigning and speak to my fellow citizens.
What have you been focusing on today?
Well, today I'm collecting all my signatures. As you know, for a candidate, we need to collect 100 signatures, and I'm speaking to a lot of people, which is the whole point of a campaign, is to get the gist of what the population is concerned about and be able to bring those concerns back to Parliament and help my fellow citizens.
How are they greeting you? What are they saying to you, given everything that's happened?
I receive a lot of congratulations. It goes all the way to admiration for some people because it has been quite a fight going all the way to the Supreme Court and fighting for what I think was a battle for democracy. I mean, we can't let Elections Canada make such a big mistake, have someone sitting in the House of Commons that didn't receive the mandate from the majority of the people from Terrebonne. So I think a lot of people, everyone has heard of it, and most, I would say almost all people I've met, we're really impressed by that that battle and the success that I finally got at the Supreme Court. And most of them are surprised that I had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get something that was that could have been obvious and could have been and should have been done earlier. So I get, let's say the response is excellent.
And those who are not impressed, though, Natalie, what are you telling them?
Well, in most cases, the people that are what I call non-impressed are just people that don't want to vote or are tired of elections. They just might not vote.
Your case is a pretty strong example of why, to counter that idea that one vote doesn't make a difference. You and your team certainly are living what I would imagine is at the top of the nightmare list for any campaign, to see this come down to a single vote. What do you remember about those moments?
Thing is, it didn't really finish at one, right? So the night of the election, there was still one box to be opened. So the day following the election, I was losing by about 28 votes. But then I got a call like maybe an hour afterwards from the director of Elections Canada in my riding, who said that I didn't actually lose that election, that there was another mistake in the counting of the votes. So after the validation, I had won by 44 votes. And I think that's a number to remember. I won by 44 votes before we went into judiciary recount. And then it was a big game of lawyers fighting for this ballot should be counted, this shouldn't. And at the end of the day, we had a result that had never happened in history, meaning I lost in advance of 44 votes. So the one vote was never actually the final result for me, especially that I already knew about an elector not being able to vote because of the mistake that Elections Canada made on the postal code. Yeah. So I already knew about that. So the final result, to me, has never been a one-vote difference.
What, if anything, are you doing differently on the trail, or are you going to be doing differently once you get all those signatures and officially, as you said, become a candidate? What will you do differently this time?
I don't think I'll do anything differently. I've always been a person that has tried to be as much in touch with my population, with my neighbors, with everyone in my riding. And I think that has been recognized. I think the context, the political context, was different a year ago. I think people were afraid of the president at the south of the border. They were afraid of Mr. Trump. For a lot of electors, they did not want Pierre Poilievre to win. So I think the context was different a year ago. I think now, with everything they've seen, and also my fight to all the way to the Supreme Court, I just need to be myself, and people will they know that I've been a good member of Parliament, and I keep just reassuring them that I will and I want to keep fighting for them if they give me the honor of serving them again as an MP.
The context right now, it may be different, you're right, but it is also a context, as you well know, where the federal Liberals are seeing some positive polling. There have been floor crossings, as you know. What will you tell voters who might say, our votes will have more sway if the Liberals and Mark Carney have a majority government rather than be represented by you and your party? What will you say to them?
I will say that this is a mistake, that it's not the case. Mr. Carney is already in power. He's governing. He passes all the bills he wants, and in some cases even gets them with the support of the Conservatives, the official opposition. And what Terrebonne needs right now, it's not about deciding who will govern. It's about who will actually represent them. They're not choosing someone that will represent Ottawa. They're choosing someone who will represent Terrebonne to Ottawa. And I think most people understand that. They don't want to be told how to think and what to think by someone from Ottawa. That's not how it works in Terrebonne.
Are you worried about those people we were talking about earlier who may not be impressed, who may not think their votes count, who are just, they tell you they're fed up with politics? Do those voters keep, or non-voters, keep you up at night at this stage, given what you've experienced?
They don't keep me up at night, fortunately. I have a son to do that, a 4-year-old. But what I'm concerned about is the lack of trust into democracy, and that was also part of my fight. I would like everyone to vote and be willing and understand how much, each vote matters. I want everyone to vote, of course. It's something I'm going to keep working on, because I want people to trust our system, to trust the MP in place, which I hope I will get again. So yes, I want to keep talking to them. That's for sure. The dialogue is very important.
Nathalie, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nathalie Sinclair Degagné is the Bloc Québécois candidate in the riding of Terrebonne. That's where we reached her. Tomorrow, we'll have an interview with Liberal candidate Tatiana Auguste. For decades, Alain Legere was known as the monster of the Miramichi. In January 1987, he was sentenced to life in prison for killing an elderly shopkeeper during a home invasion and robbery in Black River Bridge, New Brunswick, and sexually assaulting the shopkeeper's wife. While serving that prison sentence, he was taken to hospital in Moncton to be treated for an ear infection and escaped custody. During the 7 months he spent on the run, communities along the Miramichi River and across the province were on edge as he brutally murdered four more people in three separate attacks. Alain Legere died on Monday at the Edmonton Institution in Alberta. He was 78. André Vigneault is a reporter with the CBC who covered the murders and the trial. He's the co-author of the book Terror, Murder, and Panic in New Brunswick. We reached him in Shediac.
André, what does a death like this one bring up for you?
Oh, a lot of bad memories and a lot of emotions that I shared with the people on the Miramichi. As a reporter, I practically lived up there for a good part of 7 months from the time he escaped on May 3rd, 1989, till the day he was captured on November 24th, 7 months later.
He took up a lot of your professional life. How have you been able to manage the impact of covering something and someone like that for so long?
I decided about 10 years ago I would never talk about Alain Legere again until the day he died. So this is Alain. I heard the rumor yesterday that he was gone, and the world is better for it. I had no love for Alain, and he apparently had no love for me, or so he told me sometimes. So he is, and other reports, I was not unique in that respect. But Alain was a psychopath, you know, and so he created a lot of harm for a lot of people, violently and otherwise, over that 7 months and even before then.
His when he was on the run, it was a terrifying time, as you well know, for people there. Two of the victims at that time were Donna and Linda Tawney, the sisters. In 1989, one of their neighbors, Edith Russell, spoke to, as it happens, and former host Michael Enright. Here's a little bit about what Edith Russell said at that time.
Everybody talks about it. Everybody you meet or see or anyone on the phone, everybody talks about it.
What are you doing to keep yourself safe?
Well, good doors, fast, making sure they're all fastened up so nobody can get in on you, and fixing your basement windows so no one can get in that way.
Do you remember that kind of shift and what people were doing in Miramichi? People like Edith trying to stay safe?
I remember Edith, because I did interview her. Yeah. I remember the fact that people did lock their doors. He brought out guns. There was a big town hall meeting. I remember about 300, 400 people there. They were angry with the RCMP for not being more forthcoming. There was a reward out that started at $10,000 for any information leading to the arrest of whomever. And that quickly went over to 30 grand. So, and people were really, really scared. We'd never seen anything like that. I'd never seen so many police in uniform and out of uniform, and the emergency response team with guns that you had never seen before, with dogs, with helicopters. It was pervasive. Alain Legere really frightened and terrorized that whole community.
The manhunt, the resources, that reward you were talking about, how did Legere manage to evade authorities for as long as he did?
He was very smart. He would hide out in the woods. He built himself a tree house somewhere in the Miramichi, in a lot of wooded area. He stole after he murdered Father Smith, a 67-year-old priest, and that basically shut the phone system down in the Miramichi that night. He stole his car, got on a train, drove it to Bathurst, got on a train to Montreal, pawned some jewelry, came back, and he was, when he ended up in St. John, New Brunswick, in the southern part of the province, hijacked a cab in a snowstorm, and then on his way to Moncton, and then he got stopped, they ran out of gas, hijacked another car with a plainclothes female RCMP officer, and ended up in Sussex, going the other way in a snowstorm. He got out to pay gas, she took off, and he hijacked a tractor trailer, and that ended up on the Miramichi because she alerted the RCMP. It was the manhunt came to an end around 6 in the morning. Mm. And the sun broke out that morning, and there was joy. I tell you, there was joy on the Miramichi that day.
It never leaves your mind, I bet, that image.
It never has. It never has. I opened up some files I hadn't looked at in over 30 years. I have my file on Legere. And it wasn't necessarily the best of memories, but there you have it. The reporters have to live with that stuff, you know.
How did you protect yourself during that time as you did your work? Because he was also listening to reports about himself, including your reporting. So what did you do to stay safe?
Well, I tried to be very certain. Nobody knew where I lived, or I hoped he didn't. We didn't know where Legere was. I did know that there was police protection for a Crown prosecutor. I do recall one time I was going up Highway 126 on the way to Chatham, and there was before pre-cell phones, and I got on the side of the road to a payphone, called my wife and asked her to make sure that the doors were locked. That's how scared I was. And he wasn't, you know, I lived 100 kilometers away, but you never knew.
You said he didn't like you. You know that because you spoke to him. Right, yes, during the trial? Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, in one of the proceedings in Moncton, he was manacled. I was about 5 feet away from him. Mm-hmm. And he had heard a report I said to the day before, and he said, good job. And then the next day, he didn't like what I said or report in his mind, because, you know, he was kind of nuts sometimes, and he told me to F off. So, and he's gone. And like I said, the world's better for it. I am sure people on the Miramichi tonight will be, you know, raising a glass or so and in relief.
You know that, you know, this kind of reporting is part of the job. It still is. There's even more attention on these kinds of stories. And some very much want to cover or do this kind of work for a variety of reasons. What is your advice, knowing what you know and having done what you've done?
Well, if you get too close, try to stay away from the madness. You know, fortunately in Canada, we don't have very many serial killers, but they have a way of drawing people in. And I do know Alan had these women that he enthralled, that believed he was innocent and would do anything for him, which they tried to do in his trial and tried to suborn a jury member. Fortunately, the RCMP got wind of it, and they did an undercover operation, and they got that member of the jury off of his trial. But that's the kind of power that Alan had over some people.
Andre, thank you. Please take care.
Thank you very much.
Andre Vanneau was a reporter with the CBC who covered the murders and trial of the late Alan Legere. We reached Mr. Vanneau in Shediac, New Brunswick. We've all always wondered what mice see when they watch movies, especially movies about their fellow rodents. I mean, what must Ratatouille be like for them? How does Stuart Little land if you're more like the little guy in the snappy outfits than his adoptive human family? Come on, science, we say while watching An American Tale, Fievel Goes West. Help us understand how mice experience the world visually. Well, back in 2023, researchers used AI to predict how electrical activity in mouse brains changes depending on what they're seeing, or in this case, what movies they're watching. And now, yet another team of scientists has used that data to create new video clips that they say depict what the mice were perceiving. Joel Bauer is a neuroscientist and the lead author on the study. We reached him in London.
Joel, what movies did these mice watch?
So these mice were shown a mixture of sort of sports clips taken from YouTube and also some action movies such as The Matrix and Mad Max.
Why were those chosen?
I think mostly because they are quite, they have a lot of motion in them. So action movies obviously have a lot of, action, and that's kind of what you want to capture in these models. So how neurons respond to moving visual stimuli or visual images.
And just to underline again for our listeners, you didn't actually show the mice the videos yourself. You were using data from the existing AI model that did that, and you wanted to take that data and translate it into new visuals. So how did you do that?
So we took these models, which were trained to predict neural activity given visual input. And so we took one of these models, and instead of trying to predict neural activity, we sort of did the inverse. We showed them, we showed the model of these neurons a blank screen, and then we sort of iteratively or step by step optimized or changed this gray screen so that it would induce similar activity as was recorded in the mouse brain.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the reconstructions. They're pixelated. They're kind of hard to make out, but can you describe for our listeners what is on that screen?
Yeah, so they are pixelated partly because mouse vision isn't as good as ours. So mice see about 30 times worse than human in terms of resolution, but also because the reconstructions aren't as good as we think they could be in theory. So we think that these reconstructions can probably be about seven times higher resolution than what we achieved, but what you can see quite clearly is sort of how motion is captured quite nicely. So you'll see very little lag between a moving gray background or a moving contour in the reconstructions and the original videos. So it's sort of on the it captures quite well these motions essentially.
Were you surprised at all by what you were seeing?
Not necessarily that it was possible, but I was quite excited when to see how well it worked at the time.
How are you when you were excited? How did you react?
I mean, I showed it. I showed the rest of the lab that I work in, and we kind of celebrated a little. but it is quite a weird feeling when you realize that what you're seeing is kind of the representation from a brain.
Yeah, and a mouse brain at that. It is fascinating, but it is weird. It is strange. Why did you want to take a look at this in the first place? What can we do with this information to take a look at what mice are seeing?
So in a way, it's a big just fascination of can we do it? That's the first thing, or the first motivation. But also, we think this is a useful tool that can be used in the future to understand sort of mouse perception, if you will. So we want to kind of use this in the future maybe to understand whether or not visual representations are actually truthful to the to what is actually, you know, in the physical world, because we know that there are things like illusions or selective attention. There's a famous experiment where, you know, where you're asked to watch a ball being passed around people wearing a white t-shirt, but and then you don't realize the gorilla in the background. Yeah. These types of things can be investigated with this kind of tool.
So you want to know if mice hallucinate and if they dream?
That's one big question, yeah. It would be amazing to kind of try and reconstruct a dream, but I think that's a big step, but I'd love to try.
How far away is that, do you think?
Oh, a couple of years.
Well, that's not that far. That's not that far at all. We might be talking.
It's hard to predict.
Yeah, we might be talking again in a couple of years. What, at this point, though, Joel, do you think mice dream of?
I think they probably dream of their colleagues, sort of the other mice that they live with. And they might also dream of us, sort of the experimenter, since
of us?
That's who they see a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe.
How do you feel about that?
I mean, it would be weird to see, but yeah, let's see. It would be a very strange image to see yourself depicted in from the perspective of an animal.
Joel, I appreciate this. Thank you.
No worries, no worries. My pleasure.
Joel Bauer is a senior research fellow at the Sainsbury Wellcome Centre for Neural Circuits and Behaviour at University College London. We reached him in London. Hoobastank with The Reason, in which Hoobastank's singer goes on to explain that the reason is you. Now, Hoobastank has never given an acceptable reason why they're called Hoobastank, because there is no acceptable reason. But we can agree they did the bare minimum here. They called a song The Reason, and they shared the reason. You, like I said. That kind of clarity is important. You can't say, I found a reason for me to change who I used to be, and then just say the reason is because. And you also can't say that when you've canceled a hotly anticipated marathon, even if you are the most secretive country on Earth. Every April since 1981, North Korea has held the Pyongyang Marathon. And as of the early 2000s, it started welcoming runners from all over the world, just for a few strictly supervised days, mind you, and just through one British-owned tour group. This year's event was sold out. 200 runners were all set to enjoy everything the regime has to offer, except for the vicious repression. But now the tour group, Koryo Tours, has announced that the race is off. On its website, it shared the note it had received from North Korea's official athletics association, which thanked everyone for their interest, but explained that, quote, we will cancel the 2026 Pyongyang International Marathon this year due to some reasons, unquote. Yeah, they're canceling it due to some reasons. That is not, it's not informative. Reasons are the reasons everyone does everything. Could you be more specific, please? This is like if Hoobastank sang, unsatisfying. But of course, this is hardly the first time North Korea has been unreasonable. Now I have to stop talking for some reasons. And here, for other reasons, is Julie Dwaron with Good Reason. Julie Dwaron with Good Reason.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, an Iranian-Canadian historian tells us the country's opposition is very much divided. But he says he's still trying to be cautiously optimistic that change will come whenever the war finally comes to an end.
And a woman whose neighborhood in Nairobi was hit by flooding tells us how she and her children are coping after some of their neighbors' homes were washed away. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Now that we have finally found our way back, all we have to do.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered, KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. We'll have more great music at 10 o'clock, Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. And we thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community. KAXE kicks off our 50th birthday celebration with the People Powered Pilsner. It's a collaboration with Clackow Brewing in Grand Rapids, Bemidji Brewing, and Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. Join us this Friday from 4 to 7 at Bemidji Brewing for a beer release party.
There was no respite from the bombs in Tehran overnight or today, but as the war entered its 11th day, it is unclear just how long it will last. Yesterday, U.S. President Donald Trump told a reporter the war was, quote, very complete, pretty much, unquote. And then hours later, he said the war would end soon, but not this week, because although the U.S. had won, as he put it, it had not yet, quote, won enough. So we don't know when the war will be over. We also don't know what will happen after that, especially for Iranians inside and outside the country. Arash Azizi is an Iranian-Canadian historian and the author of What Iranians Want. We reached him in New York.
Arash, you've heard what the U.S. president has said. What is your assessment on when this war is actually likely to end?
It looks like the president in many ways is finding an off-ramp. He doesn't like how long it has taken. It also appears that he's kind of surprised that, oh, well, I killed one leader. How come the next one just doesn't, walk the way I want and agree to everything I want? So, look, I think the president will try to seek a way out. I think Iran will probably be happy with that. I think maybe not tonight, but in a couple of days, they'll probably be happy if the war stops. Of course, the Islamic Republic, frankly, can claim a serious victory on their side. They can say, look, you came, you hit. You killed our leader, but we just stood firm. Mm-hmm. The regime is intact. The uprising, you said, didn't happen. And we elected as supreme leader exactly the guy who you had told us not to. Of course, they'll face a ruined country in many ways that will have problem paying the bills and many other problems.
Do you think it's a matter of days then?
Predictions are always kind of a fool's game in this region. But I do think at this point is likely that a ceasefire of sorts will be achieved within a week. But, without any sort of an agreement, basically. Yeah.
You know, we've certainly spoken to many people over the last 10 days, many Iranians from all different perspectives, you know, Iranians inside Iran, outside as well. One guest I spoke with who is very much for this U.S.-Israeli intervention, this war, he lives in Canada and said that he thinks the regime has been weakened enough. And when this war ends, people will take to the streets and bring the kind of regime change that many people would like to see. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, bless your guest. I guess we'll see. If I had this confidence in predicting events, I would, you know, open up a shop and call myself Nostradamus. I mean, you know, no, I don't think that is likely, unfortunately. Of course, I'd like to see people uprising that brings down the regime. But look, the worst thing that, frankly, people like your guest and many in the Iranian opposition have done is that they've made this look like easy. It's as if, you know, we push a button and the regime comes down. When you make something sound so easy and then it doesn't happen, you demoralize people and you also don't do the hard work that is necessary to get there, which is to organize an opposition, to organize the kind of networks that you need to win. So no, I don't think, while I don't think it's impossible that there will be some sort of a spontaneous uprising, nothing that I know makes it sound like a likely event.
You've written about what Iranians want in the past. You know that people are coming at this from very different positions and opinions. Can those divisions and disagreements be mended in the aftermath of this war? How might that happen?
Sure they can. I mean, look, in the Iranian opposition, which I do believe most people in Iran don't like the regime and they oppose it. In the Iranian opposition, we have, let's say, two very different poles. We have Reza Pahlavi, leader of the sort of monarchist who has many supporters inside Iran, and Amir Hossein Mousavi, former prime minister of the Islamic Republic, a favorite of its regime founder Ayatollah Khomeini, who nevertheless has become an opponent of the regime and now calls for an end to it. He calls for a constitutional unconvention to end to it. They have a lot of differences, Mr. Pahlavi and Mousavi. But when they talked about the conditions of unity for Iranians, they sounded awfully similar, i.e. they want elections for a constituent assembly. They want commitment to Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They want religion out of politics or out of government. And they want the territorial integrity of Iran to be safeguarded. So you can have a very broad coalition, theoretically. The problem is that there are so many actual strategic differences that has put Iranians aside from each other. So look, I think theoretically it's possible, but it would require a lot of hard political work that I don't see happening yet. Later this month, I'm going to London to take part in what is called Iran Freedom Congress, mm-hmm. where many Iranian opposition are coming. We'll see what happens there. But you know, it's certainly possible for Iranians to unite.
I wanted to ask you about Iran's new leader, the old leader's son, Mojtaba Khamenei. How would you describe him?
First of all, the real answer is that he's a black box. We don't really know anything about this guy. He's never given a single public interview. What we know about him is not good. I.e., people who have spoken about him, who know him, see him as being beyond a lot of repression in Iran, as being a sort of a link person between the supreme leader's office, i.e. his father's office, and the security repressive services. Now, of course, there are some of his supporters who say, no, I spoke to one of his supporters this morning who said, no, Mojtaba is great. You know, he's the new MBS. He's going to be like the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, a modernizing figure that will very much make things better for Iran. And he's young. And, you know, some people who I respect also have expressed this hope. But the truth is, A, we don't really know who this guy is. B, he hasn't showed his face in like 2 days. He's injured, probably in a hospital. So it's not clear that he's even in charge. The people who were in charge of Iran before the war, you know, people from the Revolutionary Guards and others, they continue to be in charge.
You wrote about him saying, quote, the ultimate theocratic Nepo baby.
Look, I called him that, Nepotullah, because all he's done in his life is being his father's son, right? But he's basically spent his entire life in the seminary at home, attending religious classes, then teaching religious classes, which he did until he mysteriously stopped in 2024. But we also know behind the scenes, he's helped sort of organize his father's office with the security services, but he has no qualifications of his own. So it's a very embarrassing appointment by the Islamic Republic. So can he give Iranians what they want? Can he take Iran on a different path? I don't see that happening, but of course, like any historical leader, he will have his chance to show us what he's made of.
You're a writer, you're a historian. but this is personal for you as well. I know you're not Nostradamus, but do you allow yourself to think of what a realistic best case scenario for Iran might look like in, you know, in 5 years?
The best case scenario would be a democratic transition. This fight has continued since 1906. I will fight for the same thing the rest of my life. And I believe Iran deserves democracy. I believe there are great leaders, many of them political prisoners, who would like to come out. They can help lead Iran into a democracy. But short of that, I hope we see Khameneism to die and be buried with Khamenei, by which I mean the policies of Ayatollah Khamenei that were really disastrous for Iran, that brought us to this war with US and Israel, that imposed the worst kind of repression, intervened in the daily lives of Iranians. I hope that the men, and there are mostly men, unfortunately, who call the shots in Iran now, see that even if they just want to stay in power, they need to put an end to these policies and seek a new beginning with the Iranian people, seek a new beginning with our region, our regional neighbors, and with the world. That's certainly something that I think is possible in the short to medium term. And I continue to wish for it. I can't predict the future, but I can remain cautiously hopeful about the next chapter in my country's history.
Arash, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Arash Azizi is an Iranian-Canadian historian and the author of What Iranians Want. We reached him in New York. The cuts were deep, and Nova Scotians let the premier know they hurt. For the past 2 weeks, Tim Houston has been savagely criticized for a proposed $130 million reduction in grants that would have an impact on the arts, programs for seniors and people with disabilities, climate change, students, the list goes on. Premier Houston said the cuts were necessary as the province contends with a hefty deficit. But that explanation wasn't good enough for Colin Stevenson. His daughter, Abby, has severe epilepsy and relies on one of the day programs whose funding was being cut. He told Neil what that would mean for his family.
She is blissfully unaware of what's coming on April 1st. What we know is it's going to change for her, and her in the moment, she's the most in the moment person there is, her in the moment joy of being in that setting is at risk. And I'm so grateful that she's not aware of what's coming. Loneliness is worse than cigarettes. To be isolated, to have the family isolated and the individual with the disabilities isolated is bad for your health. It's bad for your mental health.
You know that the province, what they're saying to explain why they've made all of these cuts, they said that it's necessary to deal with the kind of deficit the province is dealing with. If you could speak directly to Premier Houston, what would you say to him?
That the deficit was created by choice. A 1% cut to the PST is a choice. Oh, it's a populist choice, though. It's very popular. You know, taking away the tolls on the bridges from Halifax to Dartmouth is popular. And those choices fit really well on a bumper sticker. And it doesn't address the complexity of what it takes to govern in a society. What they need to do is find the places where they don't have to give back to everybody that makes voters happy. They have to take care of their citizens.
Today, Premier Houston said he heard that criticism and took it to heart, so he would be reversing cuts to programs for people with disabilities, seniors, and African, Nova Scotian, and Indigenous students.
2 weeks ago, we introduced the annual budget for Nova Scotia. We brought forward a plan that we believed was honest about the financial situation facing our province and what we could responsibly afford. Since then, Nova Scotians have spoken clearly. Many people told us that they were worried about certain parts of the budget. And I want to start by saying this. On some of the decisions, we got it wrong. And for that, I'm sorry. Because the legislature is still reviewing the budget, we have the opportunity to make adjustments now before it's finalized, and we're going to do just that. In preparing the budget, we focused heavily on the financial pressures facing our province, and we did not do enough ahead of time to explain to Nova Scotians the seriousness of the challenge. But in trying to respond to the financial challenges, we moved too quickly in areas that affect people's daily lives. So after listening to Nova Scotians, as well as my caucus colleagues who fanned out across the province and brought forward concrete examples of where we got it wrong, after listening to all of them and Nova Scotians, we will restore funding in three key areas. There are other organizations and programs that are affected by the budget, and I know that they will hope today that their funding may also be restored, and they will be disappointed to hear that these changes are limited to the three key areas. Specifically to the arts community, even though the program adjustments will remain, you are valued. Art and culture is a big part of what makes this province special. It's a big reason why people want to live here. It's a big reason why others want to come here. And it helps to remind us of who we are as Nova Scotians and why we love being Nova Scotians. The budget tabled 2 weeks ago includes $66 million for the sector, and that funding will remain. This is a significant number, and I don't think it should be lost in the discussion. Nova Scotians can feel confident that their government is supporting the sector. For perspective, that number was $51.5 million in 2021. So under my government, we have been able to do more, and hopefully that upward path can continue in the future. But that doesn't mean I don't wish that we could do more today. I do wish we could do more today, and I sincerely mean that.
Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston announcing the reversal of cuts to some programs in his province. First came the rains, and then last Friday the flooding began in Nairobi. Tuk Tuk's cars and buses were washed away. More than 42 people are dead through drowning or electrocution. Search and rescue efforts continue, while in homes across the city, power and running water have been cut. Demtila Gwala lives in the eastern part of Nairobi. That's where we reached her.
Demtila, what has the flooding done to your neighborhood?
The floods swept away some houses and also some people. We found them in the morgue a day before yesterday.
I'm sorry. Is your home still standing?
Yes, mine is still standing.
We were trying to reach you yesterday, but like a lot of people, you know, you didn't have electricity, your phone died. How are things today?
Today things are at least good, but we don't have water since floods caused the shortage of water. But in our area, the whole area doesn't have water. The electricity is back, and the water is now flowing as normally.
I can hear one of your children, a year old, I think, and the other is 13.
Yes, I have 1 year and 13.
How are they doing?
They are fine, but coping up with the situation and asking many questions.
Yeah, and what do you tell them?
I just tell them this is where life is. We are living here because this is where I can afford.
Yeah.
We cannot go to other places where I cannot afford. So this is our home, and you have to love our home the way it is.
Yeah.
Until the day that doors will open and then life becomes better, we might shift this area.
How are you coping without any water? How are you getting through the day with your children?
Yeah, we're trying to look for people. They are called the people who sell water with cats. We buy one jerry can. It's now 60 shillings.
60 shillings for one jerry can. A jerry can is not very big. How do you make that last?
Yes, 20 liters. Yeah. And it can't last even. The way you use it, you just minimize water because that is only for cooking. You can't wash the utensils. You can't wash your house.
Nairobi has experienced this before. When did you realize that this was different than what has happened before?
2023-2024, we had floods also. We had floods, and we thought that 2025, the government will take the precautions, and with the disaster management funds, it will help the city to make the drainage system. But when it rained on Friday, we saw things, they are worse. We noticed that the government didn't do anything in 2023-2024, yet there is a budget allocation for that. So everything was messed up on that day. And when it was raining, it was so traumatizing seeing the drainage are blocked. And in those past years, we lost some people. So it was traumatizing seeing the drainage are blocked. In my perspective, I saw that we are going to lose more other people the way the rain is raining. And more houses will go with water.
Where were you when the rain started to fall? Were you at home?
No, I was at Kibra. I was doing a research in Kibra, and the rain got me there. Coming home, it wasn't easy because I reached home around 2 a.m.
How did you get home?
Coming home, I found there is a friend of mine who came to pick me up. And he told me that he had maneuvered, looking for a way where he cannot find a water flooding.
Mm-hmm. How far did you have to travel when you were away from home when the rain started?
It's 6 kilometers.
Okay. Is there any sign of help from officials or aid groups, the government?
Not yet. Not yet.
Is there any word on when you might get some help and the water situation might be fixed?
I don't think so. I've not seen any government official reacting. In our country, we have money because in every sector there is money. But the corruption, we have those leaders who call themselves bourgeoisie. They take control of the country, so they use money for their own purposes, like the president.
Do you feel safe in your home right now?
I'm not safe because even the security is down. The security people, they don't do their work. You find guys here stabbing people while stealing them, and the police is just nearby.
Mm-hmm. Is that always a concern, or just after the floods?
It's always there. That's always happens.
What will you do next, Demtila?
For now, I don't have any plan. We wanted to take the small girls, help them with the sanitary towels, talk to them, look for clothes, and help those who don't have. That's the only plan that we have. The ones that their houses went with water, with the flooding, we'll help them with clothes.
You're helping other people.
From well-wishers. Yes. We just helping ourselves because no one will come to rescue us and no one will help us.
Demtila, I appreciate this in the middle of everything. You have your hands full and your baby there as well. Please take care.
Mm. Hey, thank you.
Demtila Gwala lives in Nairobi, Kenya. That's where we reached her. Yesterday at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan, mourners attended the funeral mass for salsa legend Willie Colon. Mr. Colon died in February at the age of 75, and at Monday's service, friends, family, and fellow musicians gathered to say goodbye to the pioneering trombonist, singer, and composer who once said the genius of salsa was the freedom. There were no rules. Willie Colon also once said that he had switched from trumpet to trombone as a kid because he loved the trombone's roar. And after yesterday's service, as his casket was carried out, dozens of trombonists who had gathered outside made their instruments roar in tribute. trombonists paying tribute to the late salsa legend Willie Colon yesterday as his casket was carried out of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan. That was our sound of the day.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.